Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
There was a book that encapsulated what many people think about work. The title particularly encapsulated it. Work is Hell. It's a book of cartoons, but there's certainly some serious allegations. It's rather a subversive book behind its little cartoony appearance. And I just thought it'd be kind of fun to trigger a conversation about your opinion about whether work is hell, heaven, purgatory, and, of course, situationally variable. I mean, if you're in a carcinogenic, clanging iron foundry with a boss screaming by your down your neck with no job security, working, you know, 29 hours a week to avoid Obamacare, that's going to be closer to hell. And if you are self-employed and making plenty of money doing exactly what you like and what you believe is an ethical work life, your work is great. But, you know, we're all somewhere in the middle, and I just thought it'd be fun to talk about that that core issue. So to trigger our discussion, I'm going to read you a little section of this. Of course, there are cartoons around it. And this first thing is called How to Face Up to Your First Job.
Don't be a fool, stay in school.
How many times have you heard that wise old rhyme? Plenty, we bet, and there's a good reason. School is good. School is important. School prepares you for the future by sitting quietly in neat rows for long periods of time, doing exactly what you're told in school. You are preparing to sit quietly in neat rows for long periods of time, doing exactly what you're told as an adult. And remember, if you stay in school for years and years, you'll delay for a while your worst working fears. This little chapter continues. What kind of work do you really want to do for the rest of your life? Don't take this question lightly. The answer could very well affect your entire future. Do not take pleasure in adding up column after column of meaningless numbers. Or is your idea of a good time wading through mountains of bureaucratic gibberish? Do you utterly enjoy mindless, heavy manual labor, or would you rather sit on your butt behind a desk for decades while your arteries harden and your muscles turn to mush? Do you want to work in an office full of devious, bitter, nervous wrecks who all resent each other? Or would you rather toil alone in a windowless room with no distractions and be watched by a security camera? Do you enjoy being bullied by several small bosses, or would you rather be bullied by one big boss? Are you willing to give up all your youthful wild dreams and soaring ambitions for a boring but secure job, or would you rather refrain from selling out and spend the rest of your life working at a series of worthless, marginal jobs with no future on the slim chance that someday your luck will miraculously change? That is one. Let me see if I want to. Is there one more I want to read, or does that give you the kind of a... let me read you one more. This is called The Game of Work. I might as well give out the phone number now, though. I mean, that's more than enough trigger for your thoughts. Is your work hell? Is your work heaven, purgatory? Just want to tell your work story. For better and for worse, all I ask for is your truth. Not what you're supposed to say. Speak your truth. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nimco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Okay, this is another chapter in the book, Work is Hell, is called The Game of Work. And this is like a board game, you know, like your Candyland, you go around the board. Your bed, begin and end here. Fight traffic all the way home. Eat a lousy dinner. Fight with your spouse. Fall asleep. Oh, I guess this is the reverse order. Let me change the order. Okay, so from your bed, late again, gulp down a cup of scalding instant coffee. Run out the door in a disheveled state, fight the morning traffic jam, and arrive at work completely frazzled with only 8 hours to go. Get screamed at the moment you walk in. Top of the morning to your boss. Oh, shut up. Get your work evaluated. You screwed up everything again, stupid. Discover the teachers of a, something, the treachery of a coworker who has squealed on you to the boss. He did it. He did it. Coffee break. Non-dairy cream. Artificial sweetener. Blame someone else for your mistakes. You screwed up everything again, stupid. Get paranoid. Are they trying to make you miserable so you'll get fed up and quit? Start a plot against a coworker to make him or her so paranoid and miserable that he or she will get fed up and quit. Affliction corner. Choose one. Headaches, ulcers, exhaustion, depression, voices in your head. Using only some pushpins and an eraser, make yourself a little pig. Space out for a few minutes. Snap back to reality and hope no one's noticed. Lunch. Tasteless salad and sugarless gum or greasy burger and a couple of beers. Laugh weakly at one of the boss's unfunny jokes. Become paralyzed by dissatisfaction, pessimism, and hostility. I hate everything. This work is pointless. Why is everybody so grumpy? Conduct a secret love affair with one of your coworkers, making sure you never get caught. Within 2 weeks, realize that everyone in the office knows. It's 2 or 3 hours till quitting time. Start winding down, tidying up your desk, stretching, gabbing, and thinking about dinner. I'm having fish sticks tonight. Ugh. Fight traffic all the way home, eat a lousy dinner, fight with your spouse, fall asleep watching TV, and stagger off to bed where you can have nightmares about work. Okay. Now, you could say this is too cynical and that most workers are happy. You know, there have been studies on both sides. There have been many studies that show that most people are actually quite satisfied at work and happier at work than they are in the joy than they are at the joys of home. And then there are others, you know, who find that people are unhappy. The older I get, and the, you know, even though my PhD is in the evaluation of innovation and research and all that stuff, the older I get, the more I realize that so much research is subject to investigator bias. What they come in with, what they want to find, they find. There's always a way. It's not just with statistics. It's choosing your question. It's choosing your sample size. It's choosing how you ask the questions. It's subtle ways in which you manipulate the findings. You know, really, in the end, what's really critical is trusting your common sense, as corny and anti-intellectual as it sounds. And I can only say this because I have a PhD from Berkeley and I taught there in the graduate school. I really am very suspicious about almost even science research. I was listening to a philosophy talk as I was walking in, as I was driving in today. And they're citing research regarding the environment sustainability as though it was fact. And there's so much that, you know, every researcher knows garbage in, garbage out. How much, you know, how good is the data going in based on the projections? How much is it really, yes, the increased amount of carbon in the air is higher than in the last 10 million years. Is that a net bad or is that a net good? Are there unintended consequences? We tend to view things, we have the mainstream believing that the planet is about to collapse and they're invoking certain data. Then there is a much, much smaller subset of what those people call deniers who think that we're not adequately looking at it. The point is, research is what we have deified and seen as the more objective source of truth. And I wish it were true. I mean, that's why I damn got my PhD in that, because I figured that was going to get me closer to truth, understanding how to do research, interpret research, etc. But the older I get, the more I realize that investigator bias, all of us, seem to be getting ever more ossified in our views about everything. Because we, you know, our society's mind, and I swear we're going to go to this work thing, but I just feel the need to say this. Every era has what it's called its hegemonic dominant set of values. There was a period of time in which there was an obsession about meritocracy. We think about the 1950s. Everything, best and brightest, best and brightest, best and brightest. Let's provide more programs for the gifted. Let's beat Sputnik. It was a competitive era. We're now in an egalitarian era where it's all about how can we make things more equal. And a very, very anti-capitalist view of the world. Corporations are monsters. They're destroying the world. Bosses are terrible. Workers are oppressed. That could change. But because the dominant meme, the dominant message that comes from our society's mind mold, the schools, the colleges, the churches, the media, the parents, everything ends up being of one hegemonic, dominating mind meme, one foundational view, which frankly is very anti-corporate and is very egalitarian and really is redistributive from any haves to the have-nots, from corporations to small businesses and small nonprofits, from rich people to poor people, from intellectually, let's just say, fortunate people, privileged people, the term that's always used is white privilege, from the privileged to the less. That is the dominant meme now. But the wise person really realizes there is not necessarily a pendulum, but there are zigs and zags and turns and twists about what is really a foundationally wise principle. And I invite you, as a public radio listener, to not just get swept along by the tidal wave of today's dominant meme, but to use ultimately what may be the most important thing of all, your common sense, to assess things in fuller dimension, or at least to try to seek out the truly diverse viewpoints that exist, but you've got to really search for it, because outside of the dominant meme, they're ridiculed as extreme, whether it be on the left or extreme on the right, it doesn't matter. But seeking out the extremes on multiple sides, from the left to the right to neither, may be the ultimate way, again to invoke philosophy talk, of living the examined life. Phone number, you wonder what the heck. This was all about the fact, I was talking about the fact that there is tremendous amount of research that shows that people are quite satisfied at work, and an almost as large, or maybe even larger these days, a larger amount of research that finds that people hate work, and indeed this is all encapsulated by the title of a famous book by cartoonist Matt Groening, Work is Hell. And now I shall give out the phone number again. Is your work hell, heaven, purgatory, nuanced? All I care about is your truth. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now, to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello. Are you there? One last time, are you there? I guess not. I guess my lecture ended up being so boring she couldn't even though she was next up, that she couldn't endure having to wait. So I what can I say? Anyway, we're going to go back to the phones just in a second, and we'll see who we have on the line now. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Marty?
Yes.
Yeah, Tim Jollymore calling from my car, unfortunately.
Okay. Hey, you sound great.
I'm retired. But chapter one that you read from Work as Hell,
yeah,
was invited some thought. I've had a spotted work history, and I've loved work and hated work. But the second chapter, The Game,
right,
leads me to say that the book is unconvincing to me, as much as I've heard of it. I haven't read the cartoons.
Right.
I looked at them. Because it, as they say these days, train going by, goes over the top. I think he's describing a person who is totally cowed by his work and the world. Has a very bad diet and has a negative outlook on what he can accomplish at work. So that was not convincing.
Well, humor is about extremes, and cartoons are about extremes. And so your point is certainly well taken. I don't think one can ever take a comedian or a cartoonist literally, but it was there to evoke the question. There really are a lot of people who feel very like they are marionettes in a system where you have to be an automaton, where you have to smile. You can be pleasant, but you can never be ecstatic. You certainly can't be angry. You're not allowed to be sad. You must be pleasant. And yes, there are people, especially in an era where there are ever fewer full-time benefited ethical jobs, there are people who are doing whatever it takes to get you fired or at least perceived as less desirable than them. And I think that was, I've avoided the cynicism of such anti-work people in the past. And, you know, when you do the show 26 years, you think, okay, what the hell can I do that's different? And that's what that was about. What's your reaction to that?
Well, yeah, I think that's a point well taken. One thing I wanted to bring up, along with what you've just said, and the game, it does mention commuting, and I think that's a... You've probably done something. I only catch the show occasionally, but you've probably done something on commuting. And what place the commute should take in evaluating a job offer, if you're so lucky to get one these days.
Right.
And what is the long-term effect on, in the working world of commuting?
Love the question. I have in passing when people call talk about it. Let me do a minute or so riff on my thoughts about commuting.
Sure.
First of all, the reason, you know, there have been study after study lately, I think one just came out of Pew or Brookings, that the average commute time is increasing tremendously. And certainly here in the Bay Area, because the master plan calls for no building of any new freeways, despite a 30% increase in population for the next 20 years, it really reminds me of the movie They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Which was all about, they keep you dancing and dancing till the last, everybody's fallen except the last two. They're squeezing you in the same number of freeways with all these more people, and they're just making it so ever more horrific that you finally say, the hell with it, I am going to work at home, I'm going to telecommute. I have a dear friend who's in, you know, a lifelong friend, and I can no longer visit him because he's just 15 miles away. But from my home on the Berkeley-Oakland border, and he's in Marin at a rehab facility, it would take me an hour each way on the weekend. And so they want you to not travel. There is this view, again, it's an environmentalist view that says that we will somehow reduce our carbon footprint enough more by being at home than sitting in gridlock that they will build no more freeways, and there certainly is not enough mass transit to go around. So the reality point one is that the commute becomes an ever greater issue in terms of deciding what work you're going to choose. And of course, ever more people are wisely choosing to telecommute at least one day a week. If you telecommute 5 days a week, you're too much very often out of sight, out of mind, and then you get kind of ignored by the company or marginalized. Also, there is a certain amount of humanity that comes from being in the workplace, certain amount of practicality that needs to be done in the workplace. So ever more people, I think, are wisely coping with this unbelievable lack of access of transportation and mobility by telecommuting part-time. I think that's a good thing. And, of course, I'll just stop there. I think it's a great idea to consider commute as a major part. And long-term, in terms of the impact, do you know how many people who I speak to who have to commute from, say, Oakland or Berkeley, or let alone Walnut Creek, or let alone Modesto, are saying their life is ruined? They come home exhausted. They give their best hours of their work life, you know, when they're fresh, while they're sitting in the damn traffic. And then they come home and they're short-tempered. And all they want to do is, as per the workers' health thing, they want to, you know, eat, go to sleep, stare in front of the tube or play a video game and then crash. I think it's a nightmare what we're doing with transportation. And it's a tremendously long-term wasting away of people's talent, energy, passion, and desire for life. What do you think?
I agree completely, with perhaps one caveat. I don't think telecommuting, well, it's one of the answers, but I don't think it's the only one. I think perhaps some people are making the decision not to commute and taking a lesser job or a lower salary.
Absolutely.
Because the corporations and the corporate world isn't going to locate themselves where you want to be.
Some are. They definitely are. There's been a tremendous boom around the 680 corridor, you know, in like Livermore and Pleasanton and that area for that exact reason. Because many people, when there still were freeways, they felt okay about living on the 680 corridor or in the, you know, relative exurbs.
Right.
And so, but now it's crazy. So the corporations have been forced to, and not just corporations, nonprofits are the same thing. They are indeed moving away from the inner city because it's just impossible to get in and out.
Huh. Well, my solution was to settle my 15-minute commute from Lake Merritt in Oakland to Skyline High School by retiring.
Yeah.
I became a novelist.
Interesting.
And now I'm working at home.
I'm grateful you have enough money to do that. You know, I have to go once a week. I teach at UCSF once a week.
Yeah.
And to go from Oakland to UCSF, you know, they can tell you to take public transportation. It would take me 3 hours each way.
Yeah.
To get from my house to BART, my BART to a bus, BART to another bus, and get there is at least two, you know, I don't want to exaggerate, at least 2 hours each way. So, of course, I drive, which is a nightmare. You know, I can't tell you how long it takes. It takes me, you know, 45 minutes to get in and an hour and 15 minutes to get home. It's really obscene, and the pride, the human toll that it takes is enormous. And that's why I'm delighted you called, because it is a topic we have not covered. So thank you so much for calling. You're an honored member of the work.
I'm delighted that you took my call. Thank you, Marty.
Hey, no, dude, tell me about your novel. What's the there's a phrase in the movie world called a log line. It's one sentence that encapsulates your novel in such a way that it makes people want to read it. What's the log line for your novel?
The log line of this novel is, it turns out that everyone at Santa Ariana, which is a fictional Santa Rosa, has something to confess.
Ooh,
it's a murder mystery, Marty, and we're launching it, incidentally, if I can put in a plug for it, we're launching it at the Lakeview Library in Oakland, April 30th at 2 p.m.
Very nice.
Now, love to have any of your listeners and yourself.
Well, I'm going to make you pay a price now. You say everybody's got something to confess. Confess to me something about your life. You were a teacher, apparently, at Skyline. Confess something important about your teaching at Skyline.
Oh, my. My. You are making me pay something important. It can be positive, I hope.
Whatever will most enlighten our listeners, that's what I care about.
I learned a great respect and was enlightened myself from my students.
That's not a confession. I don't want to hear that. I want to hear a confession.
Oh.
Hey, you're asking about, you said that everybody in Santa Rita or Rita or Rota, whatever it is, in your fictional Santa Rosa, everybody has got something to confess. Well, dude, then you do too. Do a service to the world. Integrity and honesty and authenticity is the greatest gift you can give to anybody. What is a confession about your teaching experience at Skyline that you're going to tell us now?
Teaching experience. Well, I don't know. I don't think I can do it. Yeah.
That says a lot in itself. Anyway, thank you very much for your call. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. What is your view on the notion that Matt Groening, in his very subversive cartoon book called Work is Hell, what is your take on that, and what is your personal experience? Are you there?
Yeah. Oh, you talking to me?
Yes, but I'm hearing some echoing. Are you either doing...
Talking to me?
Yes, I'm talking to you.
My experience was that when I was learning to do things like being a nurse, even though I did it, worked, you know, really low pay, hard hours at night while I was going to nursing school. So it was satisfying in the sense that I was gaining skills and competence, and it made me have many other good qualities that I can use in other situations in life. But I would say that the majority of jobs that now that America has become a quote service industry country, which is the most insulting thing I think anybody's ever said about.
Explain taking, what you why is that insulting? I wouldn't understand that.
Taking labor, you know, making things and producing things and reducing everybody to a burger slinger or a customer service phone person.
Explain what you mean. I mean, most people don't. Some people have that job, but service is, I think, one of the greatest contributions we can make. We all should be of service in everything we do. Why is that?
Exactly.
So,
give me some really stimulating service jobs then that have resulted from outsourcing all the labor, the manual labor. And
okay, this is a little off topic.
Manufacturing labor of this country to third world countries.
Well, that doesn't. It's kind of, that's a little bit of a non sequitur from the notion of service. Anyway, what's your point? I'm sorry. Go ahead. What was your main point?
Yes, of course, everyone does a service, but the people have been reduced to kind of moronic, idiotic service jobs.
Is it? I mean,
the corporations have actually the model that McDonald's uses, which is that you should be able to write everything up on a list and have even an idiot be able to do it over and over again, and people are replaceable widgets who can
You know what? I think we're all over the map here. Now, first of all, no less than the wonderful physician who wrote a book called The Checklist Manifesto, a Harvard physician, says that we all should be using checklists because we make so many mistakes. And whether you're at McDonald's, this is not some corporate scheme. It is an error. I mean, when I have seen more. I have not seen. There was a recent study in a medical journal that found that 440,000 patients die a year in American hospitals because of medical errors.
Those are highly educated people, but people who sling burgers at McDonald's are not highly educated.
Okay. I don't know.
They're very low pay, and usually they're just replaceable.
They are.
Basically, people are being treated more and more like widgets that can be replaced rather than human beings that have something to contribute. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you.
I'm basically unemployable, so I work as a real estate agent. And when I worked for big corporations like Prudential, I realized that they were taking a giant chunk of my pay for nothing in return. In fact, charging me for their web, bogus web service or whatever. And so I became a broker, and now I'm completely self-employed, and I have to go out mastodon hunting or, hunting and gathering myself to make a living, and it's more satisfying, actually.
Yeah, for many people it is, and for, that's like the classic trade-off. Again, if they're an anti-corporate person would say those pigs taking 50% of your commissions for their website and whatever, and then yeah, and there are other people who say, oh, thank God for the infrastructure. For me to have to create my own website, for me to have to create my own branding on my own name, I benefit. It's like Marty Nemko has written 8 books. The book that has sold the most by a ton is a book that was published by Wiley in the Dummy series, because it was in that yellow and black Dummy series that they promoted like crazy and spent all this money and created posters and websites and had a PR person and they beautifully laid it out. It sold 135,000 copies. Books that I ended up, quote, being self-employed and self-published sell 100 copies, 1,000 if I'm lucky. So there's a trade-off.
Okay,
and you can view the corporation as a monster, and some of them are, but not all.
I agree with you. It just depends.
It depends. Anyway, thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemko. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. Your thoughts about Matt Groening's presumption that work is hell. Hi, it's you. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
So what's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Marty. My name is Elaine Goldman, and I was driving, and I got a kick out of your commentary about work. Is work hell? Well, I'm a stay-at-home mom now with 4 children.
Now, you can speak a little softer. You're kind of yelling. So just relax, and you just talk like we were having a beer.
Okay. So I just heard your radio commentary about is work hell, and I had a most unusual path in life, and I just thought, hey, I'm going to call right now and tell them about it.
I love it. Let's hear it.
Well, I giggle because I didn't go to college, and I was fortunate enough to be born with a twin sister, so we pursued a career in dancing. We were professional dancers, singers, and actresses, so we didn't go the college route, and we basically made a living out of, being performers. And then life went on, and my biological clock was ticking. I became a mom and then left that career. And now I'm a stay-at-home mom with 4 kids and who's in school, going to college now. And I laugh because I'm in college now, and by the time I finish college to go into the workforce, I will probably be close to a senior citizen.
How have you I mean, dancers don't normally, unless you're the lead dancer in the Alvin Ailey troupe, you don't make much money, and now you've been a stay-at-home mom for a long time, and now you're going to school and paying money for that. How are you living? How are you paying your bills? Do you have somebody supporting you?
Well, of course. I have a husband.
Yeah, you're laughing. How does he feel about honestly about you having been a dancer and now stay at home mom all these years, now going to college, and all of the financial burden goes on him? Is he happy about that? Or is he satisfied with that?
Well, that is a good question. Is he happy about that? Well, it's a big burden.
Exactly. That's why the men drop dead of heart attacks. Men drop dead,
oh,
you know.
Oh, good God.
Yep, they feel like they're, you know, there is this something about men, I don't know if it's conditioned or genetic, about being caretakers, and they work themselves, you know, to, you know, men live 5 years shorter than women. They live their last decade in worse life. They drop dead of heart attacks because of the stress and work. And yet many try to get their wives to do something remunerative. But many women really just, they're in one way smarter. And they say it's, you know, it's I if he's willing to do it, I'm going to go and dance and stay at home and go take classes. What's your honest reaction to what I've just said?
Oh God, what's my honest reaction to what you said? Well, you know, it's when he chose me, he knew that, you know, that was that he would be, you know, well, I chose him because he's a provider, and he chose me probably because of other shallow reasons.
I understand. When we're young, infatuation does cloud the mind.
No, but we weren't that young. I mean, I was 35, and he was 40 when he got married. So I would call us late bloomers. So we weren't like that young and dumb.
By the way, I want to switch topics briefly. You're very interesting. I've never ever asked anybody about a twin who worked there. Were you identical twins?
Yes, I have an identical twin sister, and
right.
we were popular with a beer commercial ad in 2003. So we pursued our lives together.
So my question is, you know, people normally they say we celebrate diversity, and yet other people say birds of a feather flock together. So there's nobody more similar than identical twins, and you work together. Did being so similar facilitate or inhibit your ability to work well together?
Oh, facilitate, for sure. I mean, there's no better partner than a twin. Well, she wanted exactly what I wanted. We both wanted the same thing, so it made life very easy.
How about, I mean, in terms of, did, you know, people argue, they have different values about how much to work, about different levels of intelligence can get very frustrating. Does the fact that you're identical twins, did that create compatibilities or maybe some hidden incompatibilities that I might not have thought about?
No, we were completely compatible. We had an incredible amount of compatibility in the sense that we both wanted the same things. But things changed a little when she got married first. I had a baby first, so then then our needs and desires started changing a little bit. But our whole lives we were compatible.
All right, now I'm going to let you go. But do be, you know, given that you've said, you know, there were shallow reasons your husband chose you. I'm just quoting you, and that you've chosen a life of dancing and stay-at-home mom and now going to school. Take care of your husband a little bit. I've seen too many, really, because, as I said, too many guys drop dead of being a good caretaker. Show him all the love you possibly can.
Well, I will. I got a good 20 more years before I go into the work field, and who knows if anyone will have me by then, because, like I said, I'll be a senior citizen, so it should be very interesting.
Okay. All right. You take care of yourself.
Thank you.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco on KLW. We are triggering a lovely discussion about the nature of work and whether it's hell, heaven, purgatory, or anything else, based on a cartoon book that's really quite, I guess, subversive, called Work is Hell, by cartoonist Matt Groening. I'll take a couple more calls, then I'm going to switch topics because I'm loving your calls. So I'm not even going to give out the phone number for now. Just welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, Michael, I really appreciate your show. I just wanted to say that please remember that the work that mothers and housewives do, unless they're wealthy, is a lot of work.
Yes, it is.
Probably four or five jobs. And the difference is we don't get remunerated. So if the husband leaves, we have nothing. We have love, but that's it. So please remember that when you're talking about work and when you're talking about a provider, you know, the husband is a provider. The wife, the mother, is a provider as well. So just wanted to be a little more careful and cautious about that.
Well, thanks. A very legitimate point. Thanks for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Just getting back to the commute thing.
Right.
it's
for those who are just joining us, the commute thing is the enormous toll that commuting is taking on workers, on human beings, on families, on life, in part because we have made a decision to not build any more freeways, so there's gridlock. And yes, there's public transit, but it just takes still a hell of a lot longer because there just isn't enough of it to get to enough places. So that was where we were, and now I'm interested in what you have to add to this discussion.
Well, we could go on and on, but the Google car is an idea that will probably speed things up quite a bit and save quite a few lives. It's going to cost a lot, and it's going to take years and years for people to be convinced that they want to do it. But the real shortcut to the whole thing is, why don't we all just drive like a Google car now? I mean, when you take the first driver's test when you're 16 years old, one of the questions or one of the points is, leave some space.
Well, you know,
stay back a little bit.
This is a little off topic, so I'll thank you for the call. You know, humans are humans. I listen to philosophy talk when I was coming in here, and Ken Taylor said, you know, there are all things we know we should do, but we can't resist. And I'm thinking about my own. I would love to be 20 pounds lighter. I'm not obese, but I'm 15 pounds overweight. I would love to be. I would love to have the restraint to eat fewer calories and be 15 pounds thinner. I'm human. I just can't off. I have a slow metabolism and I exercise like a fiend, but I cannot have restraint enough of a percentage of the time to stay skinny. So there I am with this little pot belly. And it's the same too as driving. We all know we should keep our distance. We shouldn't exceed the speed limit. We should do this. We should do that. We're damn human. We know we should be perfect and pleasant and perky at work, but we can't always be pleasant and perky at work. And so, I would talk about things that one of the benefits of getting older, you do have the arc of history, of your own history. I am much more tolerant of people's failings. Instead of being pontificating what you should do and you should be doing this, it ain't so easy. It really, in the real world, it's a lot easier to be on a pulpit, secular or not, than it is in the real world. So, okay, now I think we should change topics, which we are going to do. I wrote a little short story about the real important under-discussed question about honesty among job seekers. There is study after study that shows, and I've said this before certainly on the radio, that about half, depending on the study, 40 to 70% of resumes contain some kind of dishonesty. In interviews, people are practicing like hell so they can kind of cover up their story and make it sound more coherent than it is, and take that gap and make that employment gap and make it, you know, not as bad seeming as it is. They even, and I've heard examples of this, which is really amazing, but they list their references not as their bosses. They list their boyfriends, their girlfriends, or whatever as the person who is their boss. And so when the reference calls, oh, yes, John is fabulous. You know, he's somebody who works hard, he's smart, or whatever, and it's just really his girlfriend. So there is tremendous dishonesty, and some of that comes. Certainly some of that's just intrinsically inexcusable, but some of it, of course, it is. There are ever fewer good benefited jobs. And especially if your work history is not the greatest, you're desperate because you're afraid you're going to be homeless. You're afraid you're going to whatever, or at the minimum, have to move back in with your parents. So there is tremendous temptation. And also, again, that anti-corporate view that we hear, you know, it's like the corporations suck. They're going to screw me. So, you know, they're going to treat me like the nurse who called and said, you know, we workers are treated like not people or just interchangeable work units. So screw them. So there's all kinds of reasons why there is tremendous dishonesty in the workplace. And also, I like to be fair, employers are equally dishonest. When they're in the interview, they make the workplace seem like it's heaven, and then like, people get hired and they see it's far from heaven. So, again, I want to be balanced. But the point is that honesty is almost seen as not expected in the job search. By the employer or anybody. So I wrote this little short story which embeds my true beliefs about honesty in the job seeker. And then I want to hear what you have to say about it. This is a trigger for you and me to have a conversation. The year was 1972, long before the internet. As a teen, Anthony would bet with his best friend on sports events. including rebroadcasted college hockey games. While channel surfing, Anthony noticed that on an obscure UHF channel, it's like a cable channel, the games were televised live, so he could know the final score before the pre-recorded version aired. And he decided to cheat his friend, his best friend. He would bet on games on which he already knew the final score. And to keep his friend betting, every so often he would deliberately lose. Not surprising, in high school and in college, Anthony also cheated whenever expedient. He brought cheat sheets into tests and got other people to write term papers for him. And when he got caught, he would tearfully and in exquisite detail explain how his relative had horrible cancer and he just couldn't concentrate enough to do the work. And the professor or the teacher would always let him slide with no more than a slap on the wrist. And Anthony graduated, forgotten with the rest. Anthony got a job selling cell phone subscriptions and beat his sales quota, but got fired when three customers complained that he overpromised. Yes, if you sign up now, you'll get that just-released phone in a week. Yes, even though the offer had ended, I'll submit your rebate request. I'm confident you'll get it. Oh, yes, those data minutes should roll over. All BS, and he knew it. Knowing his previous boss would at best say, it's not company policy to give references, Anthony listed his girlfriend as his boss and his friends as his co-workers. Of course, when a prospective employee checked, his friend, boss, said, oh, Anthony's terrific. So his firing from the cell company led to a promotion. He's now selling enterprise software packages to medium-sized corporations. And relentlessly closing and overpromising, he exceeded his sales quota and got promoted to sales manager, where he imparted his wisdom to his sales force. His income is now $200,000 a year, and he was told, you have a big future here. Years later, now married, living in a 3,200-square-foot house in a fancy neighborhood and driving a Beamer, his 12-year-old son, Tyson, came home from school one day. Anthony asked him, so what'd you learn in school today? Tyson said, cheaters never prosper. Reflexively, Anthony burst out, crap! See this house? See this car? You can't get that if you're always honest. Now, that's the honest truth. Only suckers are always honest. You're honest when it helps you to be honest. Otherwise, the other guy is going to always beat you and you're going to be homeless. You got it? And Tyson stared at his dad, not knowing what to think. Here's what I would say to Anthony. Of course, cheaters often win, maybe even until their dying day. The question is, what did you win? Fancier address, fancier car nameplate, fancier label on your clothes. Was that really worth screwing people, including your best friend? Was that worth having to live as a charlatan your whole life? Someone who got his degree by cheating? Anthony, you won the battle, but you lost the war. And now you're ensuring your employees and your child are going to do the same. Congratulations, jerk. Now, Anthony would probably blow me off, at least in the short run. But I believe in this theory called confrontive intervention. I believe when you do that and you really hit him between the eyes, that the odds of my having planted the seeds of change are greater in him than if I had been kinder, like saying, well, I'm wondering if it might have been wise to consider whether your values are serving you or your child in the larger good. I believe that would not have created sufficient disequilibrium. After all, dishonesty was his life's hub. A gentle approach would not likely have made a dent in his armor. So those are my thoughts about honesty in the job seeker and on the job. And now I'm interested in what you have to say. Am I being sanctimonious? And obviously I've taken an extremely dishonest guy to make the point. Most people are not quite as bad as this guy, but there are some. And there are tremendous pressures among job seekers and in the workplace to do that. Pressures from the employer, pressures from the typical American middle-class desire for more square footage, nicer house, nicer vacations, jewelry, clothes, furniture, and all the rest of that stuff. What do you think? What would you have told Anthony? What do you think, how much honesty you really, do you honestly think exists in the workplace and among job seekers. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And even before I give out the phone number, the call is online, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's your reaction?
I actually have a situation where it's almost reversed. I am applying abroad for a teaching position, and I've posted everything honestly and true and have gotten no responses back. So I'm actually now changing so that it's less than what I should be doing and should be offering, trying to get a position.
Okay. Just because honesty is necessary but not sufficient. It's just like a car needs a good engine, but without a good transmission, it's not going to run. Of course I want you to be honest, but there are also ways to be honest and things to be done in an application that can make you from just another of the 100 applicants. And these days, with job ads are listed all over the internet, so it's so easy for people to apply that you're often competing with hundreds of other people. So here is a quick checklist of the things that honestly differentiate a job seeker, a successful job seeker, from an unsuccessful one.
Mm-hmm.
Honesty in telling your story. It's one. Sterility is the biggest weakness in most job applications. They use very perfunctory language, sterile language. I believe in storytelling as an important way to honestly persuade. So if you said, I'm making this up as I go along, but to give you an example. When I was in college, I was like many people who had no idea what I wanted to do afterwards. So I majored in women's studies, and I'm really glad I did. I learned a lot about empowering women, blah, 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 blah. But now I finished my degree, and I'm still not sure what I want to do. And I've heard people say that travel is something that can be transformative and help one gain clarity. I've long had an interest. I've been told by many people that I'm good at persuading, good at explaining things to others. And I've been long fascinated with Japan for this reason, this reason, this reason. So I am really excited about the prospect of being a teacher. I have read some articles and books on the art of teaching English as a second language in Japan and have spoken with two people who have done so. So I'm hoping, against the odds, I'm sure you get hundreds of applicants, that you might be willing to consider interviewing me. I think you would find me a responsible and good person. Now, that is both honest and human and the opposite of sterile.
Okay.
Can you see why doing that, but embedded in that also is that you did those things. You did talk to some people. You did read some articles. You didn't just apply sterilely. You also had the substance, the combination of substance and chemistry and storytelling, I think is very important, is great. I also believe in, if I were applying for such a job, I would, you know, you've been in college and you've had all of these term papers and stuff you've had to write. I'd write a 1 or 2 page term paper on the art of teaching English as a second language in the country of Japan or whatever country it is. And I would find articles on the internet or whatever and distill the most useful information I could find from those, put that into a 1 or 2 page paper, end with a conclusion about your own philosophy of teaching, and send that along with your letter of application, as well as a resume that is tailored to whatever aspects of your background would suggest that you have the potential to be a good teacher. Can you see how honesty in itself is not enough, but honesty along with those things has a great chance, or at least certainly dramatically increases your chances of being the selected employee?
I can definitely see that.
Okay. Well, I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemko, because that what I just said to you, I think, has a lot of generalizability to other folks. So thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Okay. Phone number again, your thoughts about honesty in the workplace, especially your own personal story. If you can speak to your own dishonesty in the workplace or others that you've seen, and as a job seeker or in the workplace, be a welcome contribution to this conversation we call Work with Marty Nemko. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I think there's been enough of this piety on the show on my part, so I'd like to now move to something that is not at all pious. It's just something I know something about, and it's really core to the show. It's good careers, and so I'm going to take one more call, and then I'm going to give you my quick takes on some good careers.
Again, really honest, and I think a little bit under the radar reactions to these careers. But let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, Marty, I just want to say that you're speaking in tongues. Your timing's perfect.
Okay, tell me more.
The problem is there's no honesty from the top down.
Yeah. From top to bottom.
What?
From top to bottom and bottom to top. Yep.
Yeah, but you're going to solve it from the bottom to the top, but you got the pressure from the top to the bottom.
Yeah, is that?
That's got the stranglehold on everybody.
I'm not willing to put the. I really feel ethically in my way that it's both. At the top, there is pressure. Let's not just say corporate. We've talked about corporations the whole hour here. Let's talk about nonprofits. Let's say I am the head of a perfectly KALW friendly nonprofit, a nonprofit that's about local, sustainable, organic agriculture and fair trade and all that. Okay, so that person got to be the executive director. Over probably hundreds of candidates, because everybody wants to do that kind of work here in the Bay Area.
True.
And so now he or she is under tremendous, he's getting or she is getting a good salary. You know, it could be very likely $200,000 a year. And he or she loves that job, wants that job, but he or she is only going to keep that job because there's 100 other people waiting in the wings if he or she brings in the dollars. Because in the end, nonprofits, like everybody else.
Hold it right there. You need a thing called empathy. When you put a person in a job, they have a fiduciary responsibility to everybody, general public,
yep,
across the board.
Yep.
So when you have a system of judges that run a system and avoid truth and facts and base a decision on where they woke up this morning or yesterday, there's your problem. Case in point. The officer is a messenger. He's delivering a message. The military's out there delivering a message. Why are people upset with police?
I'm losing your train here. I'm sorry.
The reality is you need to have accountability from the top to the bottom. Trickle down doesn't work.
I want to thank you very much for the call. Just a brief comment. The reality is, when you're saying that in the top does have a responsibility, but he talks about the importance of empathy. The reality is that person who prevailed to become at the top of this sustainable, organic, locally grown, organic, fair trade nonprofit is only going to keep his or her job if he or she brings in the money. No, not unethically. But brings in the money. And therefore, he or she is going to encourage, put pressure, do whatever it takes on the people below him or her to bring in more money. And he or she, I have never in all my years, and I have been a consultant to many college presidents, corporate C-level people, nonprofit C-level, I have never, even in the confidentiality of my office, I've never, ever heard a CEO say, I want you to be dishonest in trying to get the money. Never. So, but there will, without even saying that, there's going to be pressure. If I am working for that executive director of that nonprofit, and I'm meeting with my sales staff, my fundraising staff, which is sales, I say, you know what, we really need to make, I was brought in to bring in $3 million a year, and I really need you to go the extra mile. And so what happens is that these salespeople, these fundraisers, feel the need, because we're human again, we try, nobody starts out wanting to be dishonest. But then when there is, for example, a donor, and there can be, you know, the donor asks a question which could determine whether he or she's going to give $100,000 or not. And now this fundraiser has got the decision of, you know, how much should I be over promise, how much good that $100,000 is going to do for local, sustainable, organic agriculture. There is an internal pressure that derives from that. And so dishonesty, to label it, it comes from the top down, is a little simplistic. There are pressures for money everywhere, and it is very hard to resist. And that's why I said it's easier to be sanctimonious and harder in the real world. And I like to think that public radio is about viewing things in the full dimension, not just simply bumper sticker rhetoric. Those are my thoughts. So, again, we only have a few minutes left. Enough of this, as I said, piety. here are some not cool. I hate cool careers because they're cool. Careers can be cool and can be disgusting. Like, I think about a fashion model. You're just a mannequin who's standing there to look pretty and do nothing. And, you know, again, we'll talk about it now. I'll take the liberal side. Objectify women by having bodies that are a size 00. You know, to sell some crappy perfume that's not healthy for you or overpriced and garbage anyway. You know, so it's not like cool careers are necessarily good careers. These are good careers, and my take on them. They're good not only because they're not shallow and trivial, like being a model for fashion forward $2,000. You know, the stuff you see in Vogue and Bazaar or Harper's Bazaar and all the rest of those magazines, Marie Claire and all the rest of them. They're good careers. We all have different values. From my view, they're more valuable than being a model. I want to talk about attorneys. While, of course, there are many unhappy and, yes, unethical attorneys, there are a couple of less contentious niches that, in fact, are more likely to lead to, you know, where there are fewer pressures for dishonesty that may be rewarding. I encourage my clients who are lawyers who are unhappy to consider adoption law, estate law, because it helps people to leave a legacy the way they want to leave it, and not just reflexively leave their money to their kids who may not need it, or may be buying that expensive perfume with the money, which is not exactly the best legacy of the money you worked so hard to earn, but maybe to give some of it to good charities that they believed in. And bankruptcy law, because bankruptcy law is great because it's like it's Santa Claus time. People may have, you know, for legitimate reasons like ridiculous health care costs or whatever, or bad reasons like they bought too much jewelry and fancy vacations or whatever, they're now bankrupt. And our laws, you know, America's laws are really amazingly generous. You can get a fresh start. So a bankruptcy attorney ends up being Santa Claus, and there is less temptation for unethical behavior. So it's to say a lawyer is good or bad is, you know, it's like saying a restaurant is good or bad. It depends which one. So I think there are certain niches that tend to be particularly rewarding. Now, again, people here, especially in the Bay Area, think that, you know, adoption, that law that really is like environmental law. It seems like every one of my clients wants to be an environmental lawyer. Everyone. But again, the competition is so huge that it's really hard to get a good job. And then when you get it, because there are 100 people waiting in the wings, you know, there are these, again, ethical temptations where these more under-the-radar niches, while still ethical, may be less likely to be ethically tempting. Okay, I've got time for one more. Do I have time for one more? I think I do. Okay, audiologist. I got these listed in alphabetical order. As the boomers age, they need hearing aids, which are getting more effective, and they're getting smaller all the time. People, no matter, even if you're older, there's vanity. Vanity exists. We're all vain. I talked with a woman who's 75 years old. I didn't talk about my mother. My mother had a facelift at age 79. She wanted to look great. And she said it changed her whole attitude about it. She loved it. So anyway, the hearing aids are getting smaller all the time. And in that career, you get to be called doctor after just 3 years, after the bachelor's, and you're helping lots of people. So I think that's an under-the-radar good career. Instead of fighting to, you know, above the radar to get a medical school, I like people thinking under the radar. All right, that's Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. I love your calls. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. Most weeks I do them. You know, try to solve your work problem. And I'll talk with John Capella. He is the author of a dummies book, like me. His is Import-Export for Dummies. So many of my clients fantasize about traveling around the world to buy and sell this and that and bring it to America or bring American goodies to the other countries. Anyway, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us. Growth among those who don't.